Since March, the federal government has been intervening in the economy with an enthusiasm that was thought to have gone out of style. The Federal Reserve allowed investment banks to borrow from its discount window, and the Fed backed J.P. Morgan's takeover of Bear Stearns. The Treasury has now come to the aid of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the FDIC has taken over IndyMac. What should we make of these recent cases set against the well-known priorities of President Bush and his party? Is the ideal of less intervention, less regulation, no longer relevant to the economic problems at hand? We'll put some of those questions now to Jeffrey Birnbaum, who is financial reporter and columnist for The Washington Post. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Is intervention by the federal government back in style?
I think without question. Since the spring, every major reversal in the financial front has been met with a government answer. That's something that you wouldn't expect from the Bush administration or a Republican administration in general. But nonetheless, in order to keep the markets from declining precipitously, to reduce the volatility there, and to protect the U.S. economy generally, both the Treasury and the Bush administration and the Independent Federal Reserve Board have been working closely together to intervene as necessary to keep things on as even a keel as possible.
And would you say that that apparent conflict between practice and policy has been handled relatively gracefully in Washington, or is it difficult for the players?
It doesn't seem to be difficult at all, I have to say. The Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, has been given very high marks, certainly from Wall Street, for intervening when he had to in ways that were measured to protect both investors and taxpayers to the extent that he could. That's a very difficult balancing act. And I think what's also been a hallmark here is that Paulson and Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke have worked very closely with both Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill to make sure they're all on board with whatever actions they took.
In your story yesterday in the Washington Post about Freddie Mac, you quoted Lee Hoskins, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, saying, I quote now, "Someday this capitalistic economy, or what we used to call the capitalistic system, needs to get back on track, and that means failure. You can't have risk-taking without failure."
Well, that's right. There is some backlash from conservatives who think that this balancing act tipped much more toward the federal government than it should, and that the capitalist system is not being allowed to operate the way it has to, which is to correct itself. I think that Paulson and Bernanke would argue that staying out of the markets, whether it was Bear Stearns back in March or now with the mortgage finance companies, that staying out would be far too risky for everyone involved. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are very huge players in the mortgage markets in particular. And if they were to really fail or come close to failing, the consequences could be catastrophic.
Sounds like what you're saying is, regardless of the approach that people intellectually might favor, some things are just too big to be allowed to fail, and therefore you'd better be pragmatic and bail them out.
Pragmatic is exactly the word that I think applies in this case. There is not an absolute black and white view of the economy through a philosophical perspective here. There is a view about what has to be done, what works. By these sort of light-handed promises of intervention, that's really what happened over this weekend, for the Treasury and the Federal Reserve to help if needed. On Monday, the sale of about $3 billion in debt by Freddie Mac went smoothly, and that was exactly what the federal officials were hoping for as they worked all weekend to try to come up with the package they did.
Well, Jeff Birnbaum, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's Jeffrey Birnbaum, financial reporter and columnist for The Washington Post.
America's hunger for energy is transforming wild landscapes all over the world. In northern Canada, the massive Rupert River is being dammed and diverted to generate hydroelectric power for people in the U.S. Reporter Brian Mann paddled the river this summer as part of a public radio documentary project called Encounters.
Our first day on the river, we cross paths with a young caribou swimming below a churning rapids.
We're paddling through a kind of a swirling gray chop, and the caribou can hear my voice and is checking us out as we draw near. You can see her frosty fur, dark black eyes.
The Rupert River Valley is one of the wildest places in North America.
Easy, easy, now left.
My paddling partner is Phil Royce, a geologist and a river guide with St. Lawrence University. He's a thin guy with a bristly black beard.
Left, left, draw left. Hang on. Good.
Phil's been paddling these northern rivers for more than a decade, but the Rupert is huge. It takes all his skill to maneuver our slender canoe down a shifting maze of boulders and ledges.
What you're hearing right now is the absolute full rage of this river, racing so fast that the foam is piling up 2 and 3 stories high.
In places, the river sprawls half a mile from bank to bank. A Canadian agency called Hydro-Québec plans to harness about 60% of this water, funneling it north into an existing complex of dams and reservoirs. The scale of the project is breathtaking. Hydro-Québec is literally reshaping a region of rivers and forests the size of Colorado. Phil says this is a landscape that has existed since the last ice age.
10 to 13,000 years ago, the rivers formed. The major course usually stays the same within human time. As long as some people don't dam them and divert them, then they change radically.
I ask Phil to imagine what the new man-made version of this river will look like, but he shakes his head.
Everything will change along this river corridor.
This isn't a story about a fierce environmental fight. The political wrangling over the Rupert River is over. Green groups who opposed Hydro-Québec have given up and gone home. The Cree Indians signed a treaty allowing the project to go forward. In exchange, they'll receive hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation. With the diversion set for next year, Phil and I just wanted to see this place firsthand. On a hazy blue morning, we round a bend of the river and spot a gray wolf pacing the bank. As we drift past, the wolf slips away into the alders. The benefits of this project for Hydro-Québec and its customers will be huge. After 2009, billions of dollars worth of low-carbon electricity generated by the Rupert River will power streetlights and refrigerators across the northeastern U.S. and Canada without adding to the world's greenhouse gases. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Less than a month to go before the Beijing Olympics, and industries all over North China are shutting down or scaling back production. It's part of an effort to remove the shadow of soot and smog that hangs over the Chinese capital much of the year. Air quality has been a big concern, especially among Olympic athletes worried they won't be able to perform at their best. We now go to NPR's Beijing correspondent, Anthony Kuhn, for an update on this situation. Anthony, what's now being shut down and where are these factories located?
Well, the pollution in Beijing takes a lot of contributions from about 5 or 6 other provinces in northern China. There are lots of steel mills in Tangshan City out to the east. There are lots of coal-fired power plants in Inner Mongolia out to the west. And a lot of those already started shutting down in February. And between July 20th and September 20th, when the Paralympics ends, a lot more are going to be shut down, some of them for good.
Now, what's happening in the capital city itself, in Beijing?
Beijing is a city that's very much under construction, just so many cranes and open construction sites from which dust is picked up and thrown into the air. And a lot of those will be shut down, too. The workers and decorators will all be going home for an extended vacation back in the countryside where they came from.
So if they shut down the construction sites, if all the businesses that serve the construction sites wind up shutting down as well, what's the economic impact of all this?
Actually, it's a lot less than you might think. And I think this is an interesting indicator of, you know, how much the Olympics actually are going to affect China. People say that prices will rise, and yes, the power supply may get a little bit tight, but actually, Beijing accounts for only 3.5% of the national economy. The national steel output will maybe only be decreased by 10% or so. So not really that much, and for those people who are going to have to go home on vacation, they're pretty much resigned to it because there's nothing they can do.
Now, they measure the particulate matter when they try to get a sense of how good or how bad the air quality is. But when things are really bad, you can see and you can feel it. What was the air quality like in Beijing today? And will the air actually be clear by that very important date, 8808?
Well, today was a rainy day, and so whenever there's a big rain or a big wind, it clears the junk out of the air. But what's going to happen on August 8th is anybody's guess, although they've already taken many cars off the streets. The weather has been very variable. Over the weekend, we had 2 days of absolute crystal clear air. Before that, we had very thick smog. So clearly it's going to take time for all the measures they're taking now to take effect.
Anthony, is it not just the shutdown of the factories and the removal of the cars? It sounds like there are other factors as well. Wind, whether or not you have precipitation leading up to that important day.
Yes, wind patterns are very important, and in that part of the year, actually, the wind comes up from the south instead of from the northwest, and it tends to hang over the city and be very humid. Beijing has said, if necessary, they will seed the clouds with artillery fire and make it rain to clear the air. So they're going to pull out all the stops and do whatever they have to try and get the best weather possible.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thanks, Michelle.
That was Anthony Kuhn speaking to us from Beijing.
Now, more trouble in the news business. The Tribune Company lost two more high-ranking newspaper journalists yesterday. Anne-Marie Lipinski, editor of the Chicago Tribune, is resigning less than a week after the paper announced its latest round of staff cuts. And Los Angeles Times publisher David Hiller says he's been forced out, too. NPR's David Folkenflik has been following the changes at the Tribune Company and throughout the newspaper industry. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Deb.
Could we say that these high-level resignations are yet again related to the newspaper industry's financial troubles?
You pretty much can't avoid saying that. I mean, newspapers are in a world of hurt right now. You've got declining circulation as people think content is free and go online to consume news all over, not always from their hometown papers. And circulation down means advertising is down. Advertisers themselves have new conduits to reach the public, and they're no longer as interested in reaching readers through these sort of shrinking outlets. The other key element for the Tribune Company is that the new controlling owner and chairman, Sam Zell, real estate magnate in Chicago, has taken on an incredible amount of debt to take this company private, pull it out of the struggling stock market, and therefore the newspapers not only have to contend with this structural issue for the industry, they have to deal with this very specific and very real problem for their own company.
Did either Lipinski or Hiller use this opportunity to lash out? What reasons did they give for leaving their companies?
They were both relatively measured. Anne-Marie Lipinski said that you can't link it to any one particular issue, that this had been building for some time. But she did make it clear that her editors, her bosses, her executive bosses at Tribune wanted a different way. David Hiller, using a sporting metaphor, said that he had been called in by Sam Zell yesterday morning and that he realized that Mr. Zell deserved to pick his own quarterback to lead the Los Angeles Times.
There's been lots of layoffs at newspapers. Are these more noteworthy than others?
Well, I think these are notable in a couple ways. One, Anne-Marie Lipinski had worked for the Chicago Tribune since she was an intern in 1978. She rose to be part of a Pulitzer-winning team a decade later. She believes in the newspaper, and she had sought to make it work. She had accepted the idea that the Tribune, which has already experienced cuts over this decade, would be down another, call it 14% besides the staff, and about the same percentage, 14%, in the number of pages it would publish every week. She had said, let's come up with a way to make it work. She was embarked on a summer-long program to do that. Halfway through, she announces she's out. Her last day will be this Thursday. Hiller was the third publisher in the past few years to be forced out at the LA Times one way or another. The previous two had basically tried to hold the line against cuts from the company. David Hiller had agreed to these cuts. He had been the guy implementing them. So for him to be gone is a pretty interesting moment.
And what does this mean for print journalism in this country?
Now, when you think about the newspapers that are at the top of the Tribune Company, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun, and Newsday, which itself has just been sold to Cablevision, Dolan family, you think of papers that have helped define what journalism is in the newspaper world, which itself is sort of the core around which American journalism is built. So to see that diminished as deeply as it is, and to see that in some ways possibly unmanageable, is a real question right now.
Thank you very much. NPR's David Falkenflik.